Okay. Okay, I appreciate the explanation.
Okay. Peggy?
And I remember what I was saying.
Okay.
I agree with you that the data they have is a ridiculous sample size. It's totally meaningless. But it does correlate to common sense, and common sense indicates that the patterns in this county would be the same as patterns in other counties, and that is that it's only deer at the very highest elevation exhibit that down.
So you think there are some data that support that in other counties?
They have higher elevation?
Well, yeah. I mean, there apparently have been studies that show that deer who live at these very high elevations do move downhill.
Right, but how good are the studies? Because I mean, I've seen these studies where they're kind of a joke.
But I would suggest that really the studies show is even though they're not significant, that what they do indicate is believable. I mean, it has a believability factor, but really, overall, what it shows is that really, for the most part, doesn't even apply to this county. It does. It may apply in other places, but it doesn't really apply here. So, you know, I think that what Mr. Manoa came up with actually serves to support our point that this doesn't really apply to this county.
I just think it was jumped in. I'm going to withdraw my complaint from what you're saying.
I appreciate that.
I'm very comfortable with it.
Jack, you had your hand up, and then Bob.
In the face of the withdrawal, I'm going to shut up.
Okay. Bob.
Okay. The Jackson County code on deer winter range does different Josephine. Because one of the things they don't have over there is they don't have the density standard. You could put 500 people in that area because they use that 300 feet from an established building or access or driveway or road. So it just doesn't seem to make sense to have both the density and the road standard. If you have the density standard and that's the primary thing, then I don't see the need for the 300 foot or 300 yard limitation either, because a lot of times from my practical experience, what I found is you have to put it by a structure or an existing driveway, but the topography of the land may have a building site that's more advantageous to the property owner someplace else. So I didn't have that problem in Jackson County because they do it different. So I would see pick one or the other. I don't see a need for both.
Okay. I'm going to just, for one point, Bob is a member of the public, and I did recognize him, but I recognize him because he has technical and has provided staff information to subcommittee reports. So that's my rationale for allowing him to participate in the discussion at this point. But I want to bring it back to the motion, and the motion is to either accept or not accept the recommendations and move forward with that. So I don't want to get into a discussion on any in-depth thing, but if we can keep it to just the motion, whether it's a good motion and you're arguing for or supporting or opposing the motion is where I'd like to go. So if you have some more, anything in relationship to that.
Yeah, I was just
going
to say that in relationship to what Bob said, if they don't have any density standards in Jackson County, then I didn't really understand that, because outside of the 300 feet, does that mean, I mean, the 300 feet from a road outside of that 300 feet, that was put in this proposal, but the density standard would apply beyond the 300 feet from the road. So, I mean, can they go under any density standards for any road in Jackson County?
Well, they have standards for the creation of lots. Mm-hmm. If it's in sensitive habitat, it could be an 8-acre minimum lot size or 160-acre minimum lot size, because they're dealing with elk and the high elevation things. So they deal with it at the lot creation level, but once lots are created, and that's what we're dealing with in a lot of cases, is existing lot patterns, and then they don't have the density, where our codes here, you have to do the density, and now if you add the distance, it's adding an extra feature.
Okay, Jack?
I mean, the proposal here is that we amend this to drop one of the provisions. The other provision is do away with the deer overlay, except in those particular areas, and do not apply the deer overlay within 300 yards of the perimeter structure. And where it is applicable, then it's limited to 1 for 20. So yeah. You're not really competing standards.
Right.
So that makes good clarification. Appreciate that. Any more discussion on the motion? If not, call for the vote and roll call.
Malcolm?
Yes.
Kit?
Yes.
Bill?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Margaret?
Yes.
Robin?
No.
And Gordy?
Yes.
Harold?
Yes.
Okay.
Motion passes. One opposed. So what we'll do again, I'll prepare a letter, a cover letter, to submit these documents to the Board of County Commissioners. So what will probably happen is all three of the recommendations will all go in at one time, but I will be in touch with you before I send the letters in so you have knowledge of it. Okay, the next item on the agenda is lot line adjustments. Harold and I cannot for the life of me remember why I wanted that put on there unless I was trying to talk about type of whether lot line should be a type one or a ministerial type of a decision. I talked to you about
I brought it up as a matter from the public because property line adjustments, state statute does not require a final plat. That's the way they do it in Jackson County. You come in, apply for your property line adjustment, prepare the deeds, and the deeds are recorded to move lines, and that's it. In Josephine County, not only do you do a tentative plan, but you do a final plat, and what that kicks in is a requirement for a survey if they're smaller than 10 acres, extra expense, more time, and that. And the other was the standard in the property line adjustments when you're dealing with non-conforming lots. Suggested was to go back to the old verbiage to allow the property line adjustments as long as you don't make more non-conforming parcels. And this was the example that I used.
I remember that.
Is the existing two lots that I was working with. This one is landlocked in the back. Here's a road. This is a conforming lot. This is a non-conforming lot. What I proposed was this. Both lots would have frontage, one non-conforming lot, one conforming lot that meant the minimum lot size. It just so happened that the one that was conforming became non-conforming, and the one that was non-conforming became conforming. And what we wound up with was this. This met the statute requirements as required by Josephine County. It's been accessed. An isolated parcel here being wrapped around completely by another lot. Yeah, it works. Is it good land use from my estimation? No. It was because it says if this would start out as conforming, you could not make it non-conforming even if you did that one. If they were both non-conforming, then you cannot reduce it to where it's smaller than the smallest original. So that was the proposal, and that was what I talked about, I guess it was two meetings ago. That's why what I recommended on property line adjustments is go back to the old verbiage of the 96 to 99 code that allowed that to occur and also eliminate final plats for property line adjustments. Subdivisions and partitions, final plats required by state statute in ORS 92, it is not required in property line adjustment. So that was what I brought to the.
So he submitted a letter back in January by email to Ann, and she, I think, then had it all had it sent back out to us. And in there was a letter from Bob to. Committee members, and in the letter he says, at the meeting in December I brought up an issue regarding property line adjustments with an example of the practical difficulties of the current code. the old code provisions. Old code provisions in place from 1996 to 1999 had wording that would address the issue raised. The old wording prevents the creation of additional non-conforming lots. It also gives the flexibility to make sense of the situation as shown in the example presented. During my research, I discovered that property line adjustments do not require that a final plat be done to complete an approval. There is a requirement to record deeds to conform to an approved property line adjustment. I also fail to see in the state law that a survey is required for property line adjustments. The elimination of a final plat would save well over $1,000. This process of recording deeds without a final plat is being done in Jackson County, and I would recommend that the process be changed to eliminate the need for final plats for property line adjustments. However, I would still recommend that a survey be required for the revised line for adjustments for parcels under 10 acres in size. And so that's been brought to the committee. Bob wrote, that's Bob's memo to us.
Can you recommend this bill? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think you and I exchanged a couple of emails after that and go, if it's not required, it's not required, just let it go. So,
but it sounds like you're encouraging a survey for a lot.
Well, the way it's working right now is if you create lots less than 10 acres in size, it has to be surveyed. And if we're doing lot line adjustments, when you're dealing with lots smaller than 10 acres in size, it's been county policy that it has to be surveyed as well.
But the old state law.
Pardon?
But it sounds, I'm confused if that's state law or not.
It's not state law.
Then I don't think it requires surveys.
Then,
no.
Then just strike
no,
that,
no point.
That requirement to the survey.
I did one of those. It cost me $1,300. They just surveyed the property. My neighbor wanted to do a land swap. So I said, sure. And it's $1,300 if you split between us as a simple little survey. I mean, you could have done it just with a pen and pencil on paper.
Right.
Yep.
Professional inquiry. I'm a realtor. So when you go to transfer that property, how would a new purchaser know what the lot line is? Is it recorded?
It is a recorded deed that changes the property line.
And would it
have, and you have reciprocal deeds, so the ownership will conform to the new property lines. That's how it's done.
It would be up to the purchaser to verify at that point where their corners are. But it could be done on the map.
Or if I was
there, are going to be in the corner. Not if you're going to require a survey. Where's your corner?
Well, I mean,
there'll be a corner on the map. The property will have a corner.
The property will have you know, dimensions. It just won't have the corners marked.
Yeah, you're not going to have survey
markers
out there.
No, but if they want to sell it and the new owner wants to know where the corners are, he can hire a surveyor to come out and GPS it.
Yeah, I got to tell you, okay, if I was representing the buyer, the purchase, I would make the purchase contract worded so that the seller would identify the corners, because that can
actually
be a realtor a great liability if you're just
and
going to come back and bite you.
And I understand that because I've done lots of these over the years. But the question that was put to this group is, what kind of things can we do to reduce fees, impediments, and things? If private enterprise wants to do that, that's fine. You know, that's not or responsibility of the county. The county's not liable in any manner of where those corners are anyway. How many lots are out there that are not in a partition or in a subdivision that have no property corners? There's thousands of them out there already. So this one, at least you would have a map that has the meets and bounds descriptions that are prepared and they're checked to make sure that they do close and those get recorded, so you have a perfectly good legal description. So you get title insurance on it and all that good stuff.
Malcolm?
I'd just like to add, I don't know when the state law started requiring surveys for new lots that are below 10 acres, but I know back in, late 70s or early 80s, I split a piece of land because the road went through it. I didn't have to get it surveyed. In fact, the recommendation of this county cartographer, he says, write down the exact same meets and bounds and say excluding south of the road on one property and say excluding north of the road on the other property. No survey. It would have cost me probably $2,000 or $3,000 if I had to survey.
82 was when that came in.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's partitions.
I'm just saying the liability thing, it didn't seem to be an issue before 1982.
And since then we have GPS, which is, I mean, you can go out there and find wherever it is.
And we have tape measures.
So my question before the committee is based upon, and that's why I put that on here, is where does the committee, where would the committee like to go based upon the information that we receive? This is one of those issues that's been brought to us. We need to address it. Is it something we want to move forward as a committee and provide a recommendation and draft some language that would be appropriate or direct staff to prepare some language that would follow what the recommendation is or not? That's what I was bringing to the group.
Okay.
So what I would like to see or hear would be a motion that would direct staff to prepare the necessary language to make the changes that are recommended by Bob Hart, which is to recommend that the process be changed to eliminate the need for final plats for property line adjustments.
What about the survey?
Well, that's a question if you want to strike it or you want it in.
What are the specific recommendations at this point? How many?
The only recommendation that's here is to eliminate the need for final plats for property line adjustments.
And make the change for the lot design with non-conforming lots.
Oh, okay.
Go back to the wording on that. So
That's the two.
But then there's a third you consider of not requiring a survey for a lot.
That would be a third.
Which I would.
Under 10 acres. Or under, over 10.
For parcels under. Right. Still require a survey for properties under 10 acres.
Well, we don't need it on lots under 10 if it's a lot line adjustment.
It's not required by state statute. It's up to the county of what they want to do.
So even though he made that suggestion, it's not required by law.
Right. It's not required by state law. Get rid of the survey.
Okay.
All right, I will make a motion that we direct staff to prepare language for to recommend recommendations that that Bob would use in terms of the property line and older language on the non-conforming lot and also the survey requirement on lot.
Okay, is there a second to that motion?
I'll second that.
Just second it. Discussion? Jack.
Yeah, I have a question. In Bob's letter of February, he says state law requires a survey be done for land divisions for lots counted in 10 acres.
That's a land division. A property line adjustment is not a land division.
You're going to my question. Is that I'd like to see some language differentiating
between the lot line adjustment and the property.
Okay. We're not going to require a property line adjustment where a survey where all that we're talking about is property line adjustment.
Yes. Any more discussion, Gordon?
Well, I'm trying to sit here and think about what could possibly be the negatives for doing this. I'm not in favor of having to do a survey anytime you don't have to do a survey because, like Mom said, it's getting so expensive. It's like so many things that it used to be no big deal to do. Now you get one line survey and you have to go to the bank for money to do it. The only thing, the time that I can see where it would create an instance where having a surveyed line would be pretty nice to know, and it wouldn't necessarily be more so because it was less than 10 acres, but more likely. And that's that if you have a well or a septic field or something like that that is close to a property line, for some reason you do a lot line adjustment. And you now, because you thought the line was there and then it wasn't there, it turns out that now you've done a lot line adjustment with your neighbor and your well is now on his property. Or your septic is now on
his property. Or your tool shed.
Yeah. It opens then a legal can of worms because something that already existed moves this property. Now, like I say, it could just as easily happen on 20 acres, 40 acres. And maybe it's a question of what the line is where. But the only way that you would really know is to know where that line is because all of us have known instances where everybody thought the line was right here and then when it was surveyed, it was actually 10 feet over. well, you know, my well's on your property. So I don't know if that's enough to derail this, but it's, when you start getting into smaller pieces of property where things are more compacted together, it could create an issue.
I appreciate your concerns. I've seen the same thing happen on property that has been surveyed. People don't know where the markers are after a few years. They built houses on the lines. I think the buyer beware is a good thought. If you don't know enough to know where the line is, get it surveyed. There's also other corrections that can be done if you have an example. For example, if you have your septic on their own property, we found out my neighbor's septic was on our property. For $1, I sold him a non-exclusive easement so that I can't build on 15 septic lines on my property. I appreciate your concern. That is, I don't think it's worth derailing myself.
Kit?
Well, there's Halcombe Waters Creek where the people have built an addition onto their house, and the addition goes over to
Robin.
Something. Philip, is it Robert and
Karen.
Mm-hmm. Karen and Robert. Mm-hmm. And there's a big battle between the two owners there.
Of course, they could do that even if the one had been surveyed.
They
assumed fence line with the property line, and
there's
no assumption.
It happens all the time.
But again, go ahead, Jack.
I've been involved in that personally with, like Malcolm, with property that I bought, and the property. And we're not going to solve it. The question, I think, before us, is it up to the free market and the buyers and the sellers to protect themselves, or are we talking about a nanny sort of government that's going to put all this in place to protect somebody that might or might not happen?
Peggy?
It seems to me that where the lot line is going to be adjusted, if your septic tank or your well is anywhere near that, then it would be prudent for the buyer to go and have that surveyed themselves. That seems like a prudent for the buyer rather than require it in every circumstance, where in most circumstances it's not going to be an issue, but it will end up costing extra money.
The one thing is that our purpose is to identify those areas in our regulations of distance family are either they are more restrictive than state law or are they even required. I think if this meets that test, the issue is going to be that we may pass it on, but again, it's going to be another level of discussion that will occur at the Board of County Commissioner level and or the Planning Commission level as they move through that process. But in my mind, I think
consumer protection that we do.
Yes, and I think it meets the test that we're required one of our requirements or duties is to analyze it, and then if we feel that it does is more restrictive or not required, that we pass that recommendation to the board, and then they will then have to make a decision of whether they're going to pass it on to the planning commission or not. But I use that as my test in how I determine things. Malcolm?
I agree with you totally, Harold, and I think we have met that test. Mm-hmm. Just one other thing. If that lot line, if those corners are surveyed, you can still get in trouble because they don't necessarily survey the line in between. So if you've got a septic tank or a well, there's the 1.500 feet that way, and this one's 30 feet this way. Yeah, I think you don't know. If you're worried about it, get a surveyor and have him show you. He can certify that the well or the septic is or is not on the line.
Well, and I think Bill's point is that as realtors and as they're going through this, making sure that they're going to protect themselves, and that would be to require the seller to provide a survey if, in fact, there is some
negotiation. The buyer or the seller can
do
that. Well, I just wanted to reiterate again, are you saying that even lots under 10 acres must be surveyed? And those above 10 acres don't necessarily need to be.
That's what state statute says. State statute says whenever you do a land division and the lots are over 10 acres, it does not have to be surveyed. If you're doing a division less than 10 acres, then they do have to be surveyed. But the state law is silent on property line adjustments. It's not required.
And you only have to do it on the lots that are under 10 acres.
And you only have to do it on the last call.
You're doing a 20
and a 10 or a 5. In making the recommendation, Bob, just to clarify what Rob was building on what you were saying, what you're recommending is surveyors do require to revise line for adjustments for parcels under 10 acres is essentially a safe harbor.
Well, that's a safe harbor, but after talking to Malcolm,
right now, the motion is not to incorporate that.
And I would be happy with that.
Because it's not required by law.
Okay, then I think I would need Margaret to reiterate that motion because there is old code here. So is that where we're going back to? And then, two, you kind of went off at the end there and this doesn't pick up half of what.
Okay, so there's three parts.
Okay.
So first, we now forget the wording.
Eliminate the requirement for a final plat.
Right, eliminate the requirement for a final plat for lot line adjustments. Eliminate the.
You had mentioned something about the non-conforming lots, the old code. So that's what I need to clarify. I have an old code, 54.020.
I think she's referencing the sentence.
Is that
the
one?
Code provision in place from 1996 to 19.
Well, there's a copy of it on the back here, on yours too. So that's what I want to make sure that we've got the right here. So we have the right code.
B.
I thought
54.020. It's the old code. It says old code on the book.
Right.
I don't see it. I don't think I have it on the
54.020. Yeah. It has, in front of it, it has the current code, which is 54.050, and then right behind it is...
20, yes.
Yes.
So the old code, 54.020.
Is it
non-conforming law?
Is it just B on that, or A, B, C, and D?
I would assume it would be all of 54020, but we're eliminating, and the A is really just defining what a property line adjustment is. So in your letter, Bob, you were referencing that we should actually go back to the old code, which is this verbiage here. In
Correct.
Okay, that's
for A, B, C, and D.
A, B, C, and D.
Okay, and then the third part of Margaret's, she trailed off, and I did not catch the last.
Is it we eliminate requirements for a survey on lot line adjustments under 10 acres?
Is that over
10
acres?
That's not.
Okay.
There already isn't one.
Okay.
Okay. Give me a better idea for the motion.
Any other question? Any clarification on the motion? If not, just secretary call roll.
Mm-hmm. Kit?
Yes.
Malcolm?
Yes.
Bill?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Margaret?
Yes.
Robin?
Yes.
And Gordy?
Yes.
And Harold?
Yes. Motion carries. Good discussion. Okay, at this time we go to matters from committee members. And there's two items here. One is the Deer Winter Range, which has been taken care of. And we still have the winter stop, but I'm going to continue on that one. And other matters, I think last meeting I'd asked that you folks give some thought on any of the other issues that you feel or you think may need to be addressed as far as changes so that we can start wrapping things up in the committee. And I came up with a couple of them that I think we need to really look at, and that's the ministerial review process. A lot of counties, and they use type 1, type 2, and type 3, type 4. applications, and type ones are what we call in our county a ministerial review process, which doesn't require a hearing, doesn't require noticing, and takes basically in order to be that, it would be where the staff has no discretion for making decisions. It's a pretty black and white. You check off the boxes, and that's the way it should be. And one of the issues in that process is that some cases that requires that we wind up doing pre-application reviews for some of these, and type 1, type 2, type 1s primarily. And the question is really, should the county be requiring a pre-application review? It's not necessarily required by law. Some counties don't even do that. I mean, if it's a engineer's report or something that says A, B, C, and D, and you've done A, B, C, D, and E, there shouldn't be any discretion, and it's a decision, and it's a done deal. And maybe it doesn't need a pre-app review process.
Well, I would suggest that the state doesn't require a pre-application review at all, and that when the pre-application review purpose of it was to kind of help people and help them get all their ducks in a row, so they went through the application review, and there was no charge for that, I understand, originally. And then it just became part of the process, you know, that people had to go through for every kind of application, and then there was a fee attached to it, and I would suggest that the state doesn't require a pre-application at all, and that the county should not require it, that it and that people should, if they want to go through the pre-application process to try and keep their application up, that should be optional and just for the applicant.
Any more questions? Gordon?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple of projects in the city right now, and in the city that's the way it is. It's optional. You can do a pre-application review. It costs you money. It doesn't cost you nearly as much as your actual site plan review, but it's worth doing it in the city almost always because there's all these things that pop up that you didn't know about. But you don't have to do it. If you want to go straight to the site plan review, which is a much more complex document and more money, you have that option. It's just that you could spend a lot of money on a site plan and find out that you forgot something or something you didn't follow. So, yeah, it seems to me on simple projects to require it is
Well, it can lengthen your process in some way, and that's one of the other parts of the issue is it could add another three days.
But it's valuable to have it offered as an option, so if you want to pay the fee and go through an abbreviated review so that you...
Well, the question becomes, because I was the commissioner that helped create the pre-app review, and the whole purpose, as she was saying, was to, number one, try to help the staff reduce their amount of time that they have to spend with applicants, because if they can get that information up front, then the process down at the other end as they move through was much easier and less of a problem to staff, theoretically. And it's moved from there into a much more complex, expensive process, and there's no... there's some value in it, especially when you get into more complex developments. I mean, that your type 2s and your threes and fours that are divisions and more complex, that does make sense. But for a small little, again, items that fall within set A, B, C, and D box, there shouldn't necessarily be a pre-app review process. So
I'd be interested to hear what Dave would say.
I see pros and cons on it. I understand that jumping over the pre-app is going to save you about 4 weeks time-wise, and it's going to save you $375. That's basically what you're saving. Bad part of it is if you skip that pre-app, you're diving right into the full application, just like you said. I always find things missing in applications, and I use the pre-app as my tool to help the applicant get complete, get everything we need, basically lay it out. Make sure that they have everything that's necessary to get a successful application out of it. Missing that tool would be difficult, and I think it would be a burden on the applicant not having it. That's my opinion.
So does the county now, if you do the pre-app and you pay the $375, mm-hmm. is that then are you given credit when you file the application for the $375?
No, that's a separate fee. No, it's not.
Jack?
It sounds to me like this got conceived to make it more user-friendly for the person who comes into the planning department that's going to be seeking some guidance, all of which is great, which I should think should be the attitude. And somewhere it got morphed into yet another requirement, is the way I'm hearing it.
Well, it seems to me there's a difference between you're talking about some fairly straightforward administrative action that really doesn't benefit or require a pre-app, and the next stage, which, as James says, is beneficial both to him, so he doesn't have to be the one that stands across the counter later and says, you're missing five things. I guess it's how you differentiate.
Well, and as you look through the land development ordinance, in almost every case it allows for a staff, it allows for administrative review in almost every case, especially in the permitted uses. In every zone that you have a ministerial review, and when I hear that, in my mind, that becomes what I would call a type one type of process.
Would we be going through and trying to suggest which ones would be?
Not necessarily. What I wrote down was that in any, and again, this is up for a whole lot of discussion, is that in any type of all ministerial review process, procedure application is not required to do pre-app. That's not what I had. Where I was heading is that in almost every one of the zoning areas that would require, allows for administrative review. In permitted uses, which are apparently those are uses that are allowed or outright permitted, why should somebody go through a pre-app review if it's an outright permitted use?
There are two different things there, the outright permitted and permitted.
Yeah, and I use the outright permitted use. You got a zone that says, you, property owner, have outright permitted use to put this, use your property. This is A, B, C, D, whatever it might be. Why should that person have to go through a pre-app review if it's already a permitted use?
Well, would they even need to?
Well, under our rules, they do.
No, but I mean, is there a, I guess maybe it'd be helpful, like, as an example, what kind of...
Yeah, I can't give you that. I was just reading the document and using a...
But it's something as simple as a ministerial review, and maybe James can help us out. Maybe it doesn't benefit the property owner much because it's so obvious. It's like, I'm building a house, I'm going to do it.
Well, if you're in a rural residential zone, you want to build a house,
yeah,
we're not doing a pre-app review. Okay. You're getting your permit right over the counter.
That's what I'm saying.
Because we're talking rural.
Yeah. Putting a house in a farm and forest zone. Okay, that's different. It takes it to quasi-judicial.
So I'm wondering what are some examples of ministerial reviews and how complicated.
What about a home occupation?
Home occupations are reviews, conditional use permits, and those are quasi-judicial. An example I could think of is maybe a change of use in a commercial zone. Got an old restaurant, now they want to turn it into a clothing store. That could be something that's ministerial in nature. We would require them to do a pre-app review, currently. But then at that point, we have some options. After the pre-app's done, we can say, I don't see any issues here, get your development permit. Or, you know what, I think that we need to have a few more agencies take a look at this one. We can go standards only review, which is still ministerial at that point in time. And then if it's a big issue, we can do public notice if warranted, and that kicks it up into the quasi-judicial review. So we have a kind of a layer system already.
How would you feel about just making it optional?
Making it optional on the pre-app part? Making the pre-app optional?
I think it's right.
You know, if it's a change of use and you came to me and say, I want to turn this restaurant to a clothing store or whatever, I don't need a pre-app, I just want to submit my application. I say, okay, fine, great. I send it out to all the agencies, they all come back with all this stuff. It's going to hit you right then. We're going to make a decision right then and there. You're not going to...
How about if you give them a warning?
A warning?
It might be smart to do a pre-app, but it's up to you.
That's true. We can do a recommendation or that kind of thing. You know, and there's so many... There's a whole variety of things that can happen.
But if you give staff discretion, then there is no administrative permitting process. It can be challenged because you've given the staff the discretion of deciding how it should go or which way it should go. There was a case in Jackson County specifically to that, where Jackson County did a Type 1 application process, which they granted the permit to. It was involving an aggregate thing, I think, up on the Applegate, putting a bridge across the Applegate River. I don't remember the name of the guy, but I just remember that. But and they cited their own rules. Well, then the rules in Jackson County, it says the staff has an option of either approving or denying. And the people that filed an action against them took it to LUBA and said, you shouldn't have used a Type 1 review, you should have gone Type 2, which required noticing, because they didn't do a notice on the Type 1. Well, the people were right, because under Jackson County, they had the language in there that gave staff the option. Had the language not been there and not given the staff the option, they could have gone ahead and moved forward with that. That was the difference between a Type 1 and Type 2. Robin, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to ask, you know, if someone doesn't do the pre-application and they put their application in and get denied, then do they have to start over again? And is that really saving them any money? Do they have to keep on reapplying until they get it right?
They get denied.
There's never been a denial on pre-app. Pre-app is strictly
No, I'm not saying pre-app. Let's say
the application.
Yeah.
If we skip the pre-app and they get denied an application card.
Because they're missing stuff.
Then the application is not complete.
If it violates the code, it's a denial by state statute, but it says if you submit an application, the jurisdiction has 30 days to tell you if there is missing information. And if you have missing information, then you have 180 days to supply that missing information. Mm-hmm. Just because information is missing doesn't automatically create a denial.
Okay.
Claire. And above. ORS 15247 is the statute, and it requires, as Bob says, within 30 days of submitting your full application, whether there's a pre-app or not in a jurisdiction, supply statewide, we have 30 days to respond to whether you are a complete application, you have missing information, you identify what the missing information is. But Justin County traditionally uses the pre-app as the opportunity to clarify that for you. For the statute, you have 30 days after the application comes in to declare it complete or incomplete, and then tell you what's missing. You can make the response within 180 days whether you're going to supply the missing information, whether you're going to supply some of it and a written explanation that you won't give us any more, or whether you're just going to say thanks but no thanks and not going to give you any of it. Then we go to make a decision, and we may make a decision based on the fact that you've given us inadequate information and therefore it's elevated, you're denied. Have a nice day. And then you can appeal based on that and a whole other thing. I've been a planning director in an urban jurisdiction and a rural county planner in another state, and so I've got some, you know, two states, and I've probably filed pre-apps in upwards of 20 different jurisdictions over the year. And it's typically an optional process for below a Type 2. All Type 1 decisions are generally don't require permit or pre-apps. And most people don't actually apply for a pre-app for Type 1. Sometimes they don't apply for a Type 2. They almost always apply for a Type 3 and 4, as Gordon was saying. That's definitely in urban jurisdictions. But I think as a planning director, I can tell you that I think pre-apps are valuable. Are they always needed? No. Problem becomes... And one of the issues that James touched on was scoping the application when it comes in. What level of review is it going to go to and prepare people for that? Per the code, I have the ability as planning director to make a call on what the level of review is going to be. And the pre-app is typically when we get enough information in to make a good call on that. that saves you something as an applicant, because if after we do make a decision according to, say, a type 2 process and we didn't go to type 3, if someone appeals on that basis, your time frame for a decision just went from 3 months to a year or more. And that's part of the danger of that's the shaky part. One of the issues that we haven't really talked about is for ministerial permits, if there is discretion on what you're classifying as, that decision alone is not really fitting the definition of ministerial decision. So that kind of opens up a can of worms for us. We like to have it. I would like to see a code that's a little more definitive in how those things are actually classified, because that takes away some of the discretion that I have, which one could argue is a type 2 decision, not a type 1 decision, to apply which decision process we're going to use.
Again, I brought it up because I think it's been an area of discussion and issue in the past, and it's one of those, again, it's not a requirement of law, but it's there, and it has some real, I will admit, it has some real value. And so that's what you have to wrestle with. The issue then becomes if in fact you go in and pay a $375 fee to get this all, to help you get that prepared, which in fact actually helps the staffs because they've already done the work, why should they pay more when they pay another application fee? Should that fee then be given should they get some credit for providing that? However, but I mean that is a discussion at the board commissioner level, but it's also something we could recommend to them, and then they can have that discussion somewhere. Jack had his hand up, and then Bill.
Yeah, I've got a question. Because
okay.
This pre-app thing in Josephine County, what significance does that have to the timeline within which an application has to be resolved? Relating to that, because in Jackson County, you don't have to go through this. That triggers a clock running. And if there are hang-ups along the way and down the road, the time runs out, the guy has to go back and start his whole application over again.
I'm not aware of that, but they may have a pre-app, as Josephine County does per a recent ordinance. A pre-app is now good for, the recommendation is good for a year. Because it's a requirement, it has to be done, you have to file your application within a year of having your pre-app.
So
if you have a pre-app in 2008 and in 2010 you want to file your application, Mr. Black is going to tell you, no, you have to do another pre-app. And that got lengthened. It was 6 months before, I think, and now it's a year. So that, which I think is a good provision. But if you're going to make them optional, obviously the one-year time frame doesn't mean anything. Pre-apps they're not addressed in the ORS, and they're not part of the 150-day clock. They're not part of the 180-day perfecter application clock. They're simply not part of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Again, Bill.
$375 for the pre-app. Okay. What would be the fee for the next level?
Depends on what kind of application we're talking about. In my mind, I can do. Do you want?
For a real estate agent, we tack a surcharge on that.
yeah.
A percentage of the commission.
I'm just bending over a lot.
Yeah. there's a pretty wide range. Our fee schedule, is it still on the website?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's on the website. Go look at our fee schedule.
I built a little barn a few years ago. I think it was like five or
if you build a barn, if you're building a barn, I don't know what's going on here, but if you're building a barn, you're just getting a permit. I'm not seeing you doing an application for just a barn. Yeah.
You guys did come out and look at it when you finished.
For the building department?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Building department.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You probably had another something for a site development permit. I know I did that in a garage recently. I was just
planning permissions for sure.
if we thought about recommending giving it credit.
I think, again, because it mentions that in every zone, like a rural residential zone, and it has permitted use, the following uses with accessory uses shall be permitted using ministerial review procedures, and then it references Article 22. And when you look at all of the permitted uses in the rural residential that have the potential of being ministerial, that's accessory buildings. I mean, there's a, and I'm on page 6.5 of our development code. You go through about, goes from A to, this A to J. And in that, under the terminology there, each one of those would be allowed to do an administrative permit, which could be a type 1, which would not require IE notice, and if the person filled in all the blocks and banked the check marks, would then have the ability to get the permit and go do their work. Am I understanding that? Unless there's something in Article 22 that does kick it into a, and I'm going to use type 1, type 2 as references, it could kick it into a type 2, which would require notices if the planning director feels there's a need for that, which basically takes away the ministerial capability, because that gives the discretion to somebody. So it really becomes a type 2 anyway, and not a type 1, or would require all of the processes. And people could file appeals based upon the fact that it should have been a type 2 versus a type 1. So the issue is whether or not staff should have the discretion or not the discretion once it becomes an administrative. It's a type 1, or the decision is made and there isn't an ability to move it into another category. Jack?
Well, I think I'm hearing the proposal from customer. Mm-hmm. And then you don't compromise
the staff.
The ministerial capacity. But yeah. I think what I'm hearing you say is for type 1, type 2, type 3, 2 and 3 is valuable, and it is something that I sell to the person who's coming into the planning department. It's required, you can't avoid it. But the key optional.
I don't think you can make 2 and 3 optional. Those are required. One is optional, but not 2. Oh. 2 requires noticing of the neighbors because of the magnitude of whatever that development may be.
Type 1, then it's all we're talking about, make it optional.
Yeah.
I also have the idea of getting at least a process in the application to have had the pre-app done.
In theory, it does, yeah.
So maybe instead of crediting the 375, credit them 200 or something.
Yeah, jurisdictions do that. That's fairly common.
Let me do this from the standpoint of time. Is let's have this on as an item for next week for some decision, and so give for next month. And you guys don't want to meet next week?
No.
That's a little shock. I was prepared. Wow, that's disheartening.
You go ahead, Harold.
Oh, okay.
We're not here to start with that.
Anyway, we look at it as a possible discussion and some kind of decision on this issue next week. So it gives you some chances to next month. Next month.
And Harold, is there a place in here that tells or describes the different levels?
It doesn't. Well, it has the permit review process, which is Article 22. Mm-hmm. And that's where you talk about the administrative review, quasi-judicial review process.
But as I learned from David, it's still kind of ambiguous, or it's not real clear about the different levels.
Okay.
It was a nice idea at the time because it gave the planning director some flexibility, but now to come back to slit your throat, because once you have that flexibility, then it takes it out of the ministerial and puts it in the quasi-judicial.
One other quick item, and then I'll open it up for other folks, but it struck me, I was over in Klamath County here last month and had an opportunity to sit in on their hearing process on a land use application. And the process they use sort of impressed me. And how they do this is they advertise for a public hearing for a land use action, which we do for planning. We have a planning commission process and then a Board of County Commissioner process. And there's a considerable amount of time between the Planning Commission decision and the Board of County Commissioners hearing. That's the process. In Klamath County, it's a joint hearing. The Board of County Commissioners and the Planning Commission meet at the same time. They hear the application at the same time. They hear all the evidence, all the information. Planning Commission, and they open it up for like a regular hearing process. They then close the hearing as the Planning Commission. Planning Commission then has their deliberation, makes a decision. It's one of those that would be fit as a recommendation primarily. The Board of County Commissioners, who's then sitting in the same room and hearing the same information, then opens their hearing and proceeds. And I guess I was impressed from the standpoint what that does is it cuts
down. On the record.
Huh?
De novo or on the record?
On the record. It's right. Everything's right then. I mean, there's no difference in time. And I didn't. The one I saw, there was no opposition. There was no issue. It was changing the Public Works Department's zoning to commercial, from commercial to or from industrial to commercial. But anyway, I was thinking of that. Is there a plus there from the standpoint of all parties that, rather than having this extension of time, you got the Planning Commission, you have staff preparing everything for the Planning Commission, the Planning Commission hears it, then they make their determination, and then there's a whole period of, another period of time which the staff then has to prepare all the other information, and then they have another hearing. And there's a tremendous amount of, in my perception, of staff time that could be cut back because everything is at one time. And if there's some issues, then it can be continued, but it would be continued by the board from that day to the meeting to another day if they needed additional time for whatever information they felt necessary. But it is only in those kinds of situations where the Planning Commission is making a recommendation, not a final decision. And so I just bring it up as, is that something that we would be worth looking at and seeing if, in fact, it would be a beneficial one for the applicant?
Would that relate to the rural
planning commission? Mm-hmm. Rural Planning Commission.
Is there always a hearing by the Board of Commissioners, or is that only when it's appealed?
Only if there's recommendations or an appeal. But
how often does that happen? Because if it happens frequently, then it would make sense to consolidate the two, because then you save a lot of...
Well, right now there isn't a whole lot going on, so then nothing's happening. But well, in the heyday there was. And
one question I have. A plus and a minus in response from your planning director. Plus makes it easier to meet your 150-day timeline. The minus, who do you appeal to?
Appeal to
de novo. It opens up the whole thing over again.
But if it's on the record because they're both hearing it at the same time.
But the appeal,
so then
the appeal goes to LUBA. You have a planning commission.
Right.
And the board's immediately going to hear that.
You basically get your appeal at the same time as your
hearing. Yeah, you're hearing, Gordon?
Yeah, but you don't have the final decision in front of you to appeal.
Yeah.
Having been on both sides, being somebody that is appealing something and then having been appealed, I can see both sides of it, but it seems to me that you need a little bit of time in there for somebody to react to Planning Commission recommendation or decision or something to be able to get their arguments together to go to the commission. So I'm all in favor for expediting it so that time period is a reasonable time period, 2 weeks or something between a Planning Commission recommendation or whatever. But half the time, you know, people don't even know that it's an issue or it's being discussed until it's already gone through the Planning Commission, and then by that time it'd be too late to even react.
Well,
and then your next avenues have to go all the way to LUBA.
But my first impression, and I understand that, would be if I was in a position and heard a case and it went before the Planning Commission, and I really didn't like the recommendation of the Planning Commission, but it was then immediately heard by the board, then the board is going to be able to hear whatever objections that you may have based upon that decision.
Yeah, so you might need the board to do a little research or get some extra
witnesses. But what you can do is then ask for an extended period. You can ask for continuance, but it's being done then rather than waiting for 2 months and then having an additional one. I'm looking at trying to see how does it work and meet all of the kinds of issues you're talking about. And the benefit I think of that is that if I wasn't happy with the decision or the recommendation of the Planning Commission, then the board was going to hear it immediately. I think if I was a person, I would ask for a continuance to another date, but it's done right then rather than waiting for another.
Well, that's fine, but I see to me that that would be a requirement that if somebody objects,
that's my line.
It's automatic that it's continued. Because otherwise, you're dependent on the good graces of the commissioner to say, well, yeah, we'll give you that continuance.
But you'd have a continuance for 30 days or whatever it is, but my point is that at least it consolidates the process. I think it helps from the standpoint of the staff, but it should also help from the applicant. Now, the argument on the other side of it is that most of the time when you have a planning commission hearing and a board of commissioners is sometimes applicants come in and they don't put everything on the table on the front end, and it's sort of testing the water with the issues, and then they come in at the end with a whole bunch of other information. That's the other part of that.
Right. And one of the issues with that is public participation, yeah. Which is going on.
I just bring it up as a topic of thought and whether or not it has some merit in our county. It may not work. I haven't talked to the folks over there as to how they dealt with issues that were contentious, whether there had been some issues there, but somebody had their hand up. Okay. Jack?
The objection that Gordon was raising, that people would be there for their final decision and they haven't had time to research how they're going to argue if they lose, that only has merit for what I call the official center light. If I'm going to a hearing and it's decision time, you better believe I'm prepared and I have researched, or I have no business going there. And both the pros and the cons. So what you're speaking to is our land use vigilante.
You know, believe me, I've been a victim of land use vigilante. I disagree.
I think we need to clarify the recommendation, because I think we need to clarify when the Planning Commission, it would probably only be able to work on recommendations. Is that what you... Okay, but the majority of the recommendations are a de novo hearing before the board. So additional evidence can be presented. So I think that might be your problem. If it's a recommendation on the record only, it would work. But if it's a recommendation like the comp plan zone changes, the Planning Commission does not make that decision. They recommend it, their decision, to the board. Then the board has to hold a de novo hearing to hear everything all over again. And there's usually not that great a span, because a recommendation by the Planning Commission cannot appeal that. It just goes directly to the board. So on a de novo, I don't think that would work. But on the record, it might. But I don't know. We have more de novo than we have on the record.
But that's not a decision that can be made by the board. Yeah. Not necessarily state law.
If the committee feels this is something, the Clamath County thing, if they want to pursue, I'll call. James and I could call Clamath County and see how it works for them, kind of sees what the pros and cons are and lay it out for you.
It just struck me when I was sitting there, wow, this is sort of neat, because I saw all of the stuff right there, and I didn't see a four-month process out there that, mm-hmm. number one, is detrimental to the applicant sometimes, is detrimental to the staff, is even detrimental to the neighbors or whoever might be wanting mm-hmm. to participate.
My perspective on it would be for the ones that are fairly easy, it's going to get you there quick, there's no major objections to it, it goes straight to the board, you've got a decision, you're done, and you're probably not going to do an appeal. A LUBA appeal, that being your option. Anne, would you care to guess what a LUBA appeal costs for us to prepare? Is it?
Oh, good heavens.
$10,000?
If that, probably more.
The taxpayers are picking up a big bill at that point, and a LUBA appeal doesn't cost that much to file.
And I only bring it up because I think it has some potential. If that's something the committee wanted to think we ought to pursue, I would agree. He could call the planning director at Klamath and probably get a little better idea of how that really works. Because like I said, I only saw it from one meeting, and it was a smooth meeting. And
well, and the double noticing on that would save a lot of time, because you can put it on one notice, and the time that's involved with all of that.
I think it's worth it early to worry about.
It's worth a phone call anyway.
Yeah. Bill Adams is the director. So if that's something that is worthwhile, I would say staff go ahead and follow up on it. If then, unless somebody's objecting.
We'll give you a summary.
Yeah, that would be good. Okay.
Those kinds of issues that we're talking about, process and forms that go out and checklists and all that kind of stuff, are part of the review that staff is doing as we speak.
Good.
For all of our processes to clarify things so people won't walk in and get a good idea of what.
I think it would be a good idea for you to give us maybe an update after you've been in the trenches a while now. Maybe talk a little bit about what's going on and some of the issues and thoughts that you may have for this committee.
Well, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah, 15 minutes.
Yeah, what do you want to time, huh?
15 minutes. The next meeting. Don't do it. Let's not do it. Let's do it June.
You want to do it June?
Okay. Other Bill. Did you have anything? Other issues that you think we should take a look at? Oh.
Were you going to look at that, Grace? Or put it off till next?
Okay, now Grace provided something in writing that we're going to need to probably carry it till next week, if that's okay. But is that something?
I'm going to propose that at our next meeting, we
undertake a discussion
of proposal regarding the research functions.
Okay, does everybody, can I, I'm assuming it comes off of this too. This is something we got a long time ago, and it's been
the map. Yeah.
It's Mike Snyder's recommendations for locational factors affecting woodlot resource. I'm assuming that that's part of what you were reviewing. I don't know.
Actually, that was more him basically.
We should all have a copy of that, and it would be worthwhile to look at that in relationship with Grace's the next meeting. Would that be acceptable? Any other issues that you feel we should start thinking of looking at that coming up?
There's one thing I heard. We just got this right. They sit here on number 3, elimination of deer water range density requirements.
Okay, that's already done.
Well, I think we just decided to vote for it.
Yeah. She's saying eliminate. Well, that could be another motion or another. Step two. We took the first one to test the water. Now we're going for it. We're going to dive into this one. Okay. Bob?
It's a topic that comes up every once in a while. It's the water quantity issue. And one of the things that I bring up is on PUDs. We don't have very many of them, but once in a while we do. The way the code is written today, it requires a water test, a major pump test for all PUDs. One of the big issues that was required on that major pump test was whenever you created lots smaller than 1 acre. Subsequently, the state has changed and said you can't create lots smaller than 2 acres no matter what in a residential zone. So if you have an RR5, you do a PUD, you make some 2 acre lots, you have to do a major pump test, even though you may only be doing shared wells with a couple of different lots. It seems like an extra burden to require that major pump test on PUDs, and that's in the statute. It's not a state law, it's a local county requirement. So that's something that I haven't talked with David about at all, is the water issue and the requirements there. I think that whole area needs to be looked at.
Okay. So any committee agree that something is something we should take a look at? Okay. So why don't you go with David or somebody in the planning to see what those issues are.
I'll write up something as a thing.
That'd be great.
Brief people on it and what are the issues that need to be attacked or tackled.
I have a question.
Okay.
Right now, the pump tests, they used to get kind of administered by the water resources and they lost their funding to it. And Michael Snyder said he was official Philippine County Water Master, and he says, I don't know anything about hydrology, and I know we've had some hearings where the test just didn't follow the rules and they see it all. And I just wonder if that's, I think it's just the opposite of what Bob's talking about here. I don't think we're maybe strict enough on some levels.
So that we don't have the ability to technical people in.
For example, we had a PUD application and they pumped the test at 30 gallons a minute and they failed the test well, more than the standards allowed. So they let them go back in and pump it at 5 gallons a minute if they passed. It flies in the face of the rules that you have to pump it from maximum rate you can. I mean, that's the whole purpose of doing the well test. We need some either some education or accurate, otherwise what's the point of having them?
Let me ask a question. If I'm a property owner and I think I want to do some development or I want to build something and I know that I may have a water problem, and so rather than digging a well, I decide I want to put in a big tank and I don't need the groundwater, why would I have to do a test if I in fact have another alternative source of water?
But that's not the way the code's written, and that's not the way LUBA is going to administer it, because we've had that question before.
So is it a state requirement or is it a local requirement? I guess where I'm trying to get to is if the code says you have, if you can prove an alternative source of water and not using groundwater, then the rules don't apply.
So you're saying if you're doing a PUD and saying we're not going to have any wells in this property?
We're not going to dig a hole in the ground. We have another source of water that we can provide and it's adequate to meet the requirements. Why should I have to go through the test? So how do we make that happen so that it becomes... I'm looking down the road because somewhere down the line there's going to be some other means by which people can get water in the rural areas.
Yeah, like a spring.
Well, spring or... They bring it in. I mean, now they bring big tankers of water. Tanker trucks come in and bring water in.
Yeah, I've got
some.
Well, but that's their choice.
Yeah.
And if they're carrying it, it becomes their issue, not necessarily.
Get over the 50,000 pound bridge.
Well, they're good. 225. It's on axle by axle. Good point. Anyway, that's a discussion then that we should bring up and have some more discussion on. So give it some thought. Anything else? One thing I bring up is there is a bill and I don't know where it is right now, but I was at a meeting in Jackson County, and it's House Bill 3516. And what it is, I think it's got legs, and it's probably going to move through the legislature, and what it is of creating a pilot program between Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson County. And it's sort of the replacement of HB 2229. It's where they're going to allow a regional... by an intergovernmental agreement of two or more counties can come up with a new definition or a refined definition of agricultural and forest lands. And they're using Josephine, Jackson, and Douglas as the pilot program. And once those counties, through an intergovernmental agreement, come up with a actual definition, LCDC has no choice. They have to accept it under the bill. And so it's in a process. They've only allowed, I think at this point they were talking about $250,000. David has sat in on a meeting already between some of the state folks in Jackson County and Douglas County.
What were the uses?
Forestry and ag. And I don't know where, I know they were supposed to submit some new, if there was some additional language, and that was supposed to have been done by last week, I think, and I don't know. But Dave Honeycutt and Sean Julians from the Oregon Association of Realtors are the two major players on this bill as far as staffing writing, along with some LCDC folks. Richard Whitman sat in on the meeting, but he's not, I don't think he's part of that. But
I saw an article in the paper, though, a couple of days ago that said that and I don't know if this was one of them.
I haven't heard. I haven't gotten anything yet.
They didn't go down because they never voted on it.
They didn't get a hearing. Lack of hearings. Yeah. They didn't get any hearings.
Well, you just ran out of time. There was a deadline, and there was a whole raft of bills that just didn't go down on the committee.
Well, I think that was why they were trying to get some language issues from the counties on this, because they had to have it in by, I think, Wednesday, because it was... They had to have a hearing on it by Friday, I believe.
Yeah, there's an article in Saturday.
Oh, look, I've been gone. So.
A whole
did they list the bills?
They did not list the bills, so there is still some hope.
I'll check with
them. I know there were four separate Senate bills regarding regionalizing the DLC, any of them specifically, so I'm just kind of crossing my fingers and hoping.
I know that Jackson County, and I'm sure, and I know that Josephine both were concerned with the cost of doing this, that they didn't feel $250,000 was going to cover the cost, because in the bill there's a requirement to do analysis of soils, and I mean it's not just
change the land.
Yeah, and so there was some real issue there, and it's a 2-year process. We do here. We do here. And that can be used. But Bob can tell you that we may have a problem with that system as a certain time frame. But is that a fact? No longer a valid.
Some changes in OAR 6606. It says you have to, unless you can show that there's a differential or inaccuracy in the NRCS. Soil ratings, you have to use the NRCS. If that doesn't work, then you drop down to the Department of Revenue review, and then if it doesn't work, then you go down to the Right now, the problem, well, we can talk about this in April for a long time,
but I'll talk to you about that.
Quick note,
though.
Not in the parking lot.
According to the article that Peggy's referring to, Margaret's referring to, these mills aren't necessarily dead. They can be reintroduced. They're just old.
Mm.
Some of them are.
Well, I'll find out, because I'm in communication with both of those gentlemen. So.
Yeah, but when you find out,
I'll send emails out. But if it does move forward, again, that's going to be another opportunity for probably doing some refining of the language that may help some of this miszoned farming.
This might be controversial.
I think it will be. I definitely think it will be. Jack?
Maybe next time we talk a little bit about the possibility of digging into things that we can do about miszoned properties as they were adopted. We had Bob tell us regarding the deer overlay. It started out as one thing that they did judicious, and at the end of the day, the state said you got to change it and do something else. And it's the third time I've run into this, especially on the issue of high-value farmland and forest. And so, getting out for next week, I want you to start with this farmland.
So you're coming next week.
Next week, thanks, Jack. You and I, we'll do it.
Over in the parking lot.
We'll be in the parking lot. I don't think the door's going to be open. Okay, I think we've covered everything, except is there anything from the public? This public is not speaking today. Okay, again, our next meeting is going to be on
May 9th.
Same time, same place, different issues. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your comments and thoughts. And if other issues come up, bring them up, or send them out in advance to email them. So we can...
That's the homework.
Yes, that's the homework. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.